NetBox Labs helps companies build and manage complex networks. The company's NetBox Cloud product offers an enterprise-grade SaaS version of open-source NetBox, the world's most popular network source of truth. Check out their educational network management webinars or join a NetBox meetup at netboxlabs.com/events. That's netboxlabs.com/events.
Packet pushers.
Hello, welcome to the Network Automation Nerds podcast, where we explore the latest in network automation from a practitioner's perspective. I'm your host, Eric Cho, a network engineer who loves everything about network automation. Today on the show, we have a very special guest, none other than Kirk Byers, the founder of Twin Bridges Technology and the creator of the uber-popular NetMiko Python library. Kirk is at the forefront of network automation since the beginning. In fact, I have taken several of Kirk's classes when I first started my network automation journey. So safe to say he's an OG. So buckle up and get ready to dive into the bits and bytes of network automation with Kirk. So Kirk, welcome to the show. Like I said, you've been there from the beginning, probably way longer than I had. So, I mean, I'm very, very excited about our conversation. When we did the planning session, I looked at all the topics and I'm like, no, this is like hour one of four. So we need to We totally need to invite you back if we could and see where the conversation leads us. But I'm very excited about our conversation, the upcoming conversation we have.
Definitely sounds good. And I mean, you're also self-deprecating a little bit because you've been around for a long time. And I remember early on in the network automation space when I was getting interested in it, I was seeing your content as well. So you've been around doing this for quite a while as well.
Well, we're both dating ourselves here, but but it's definitely, you know, for me, it was by chance, right? Like it was a journey where we had to automate, otherwise we don't survive. Like I don't get to see my wife and kids because it's just the scale that I was working at. So it was just a matter of survival. But what about you? I mean, you're both a Python programmer and network engineer at the same time. So how did that happen? If we like ask Kirk's origin story.
Yeah, so what had sort of transpired with me is around 2010 or so, I had tried to build a SaaS-based network automation platform. So I'd gotten pretty interested in running my own business and trying to build some sort of service or product that I could sell. And I had tried to basically make sort of a cloud-based network configuration manager. So something along the lines of NCM that SolarWinds has, or like a managed engine device expert, but a cloud-based version of that. And I'd spent, you know, a couple years doing that. And I had come from a network engineering background. So I'd been a long time CCIE. And as part of that process, I had gotten pretty good at programming, meaning that was basically all programming. And I was largely doing all that work myself for the most part. I mean, I'd hired a few other people, but it was mostly me doing the bulk of the work. And I had sort of reached my end in that process in that I had built something, but I had really no way of selling it or marketing it. And everything I had tried to do at that point in time had really been a failure as far as building this SaaS application. And I was sort of, you know, losing money in the process, you know, so it's sort of a hard road when you are doing consulting on the side. You're spending a year building this and you look at the end of the year and your business has lost, you know, $15,000. So you're like,
oh my,
you know, a certain amount of money. So there's sort of only so long that you can sustain doing that. So I had basically decided I can't really do this anymore, but I didn't want to go back to what I was doing previously, which had been just straight consulting. I just couldn't do the hours for work job anymore, like where, you know, you're getting paid hourly to do certain work or consulting projects. And I could definitely start to see that network automation with like this whole hype about what at the time was termed SDN was going to be important. Now, I don't think SDN itself was going to be important, but I think network automation and automating devices was going to be a lot more important than what it was. And, you know, since I had done all this Python work trying to build this cloud application, and then coming from a networking background, that I sort of also realized that, hey, I'm in a pretty good position to do something here.
Yeah.
And I had went to a puppet conference, something like 2013-ish, somewhere around there, that I know Jeremy Shulman was at, that John Willis was at. And, you know, I sort of thought that the writing was a bit on the wall, that, hey, this is going to be important, and there's an opportunity here. But then I also had the problem, well, how do I build a business around it? So that's sort of when I decided, okay, well, let me see if I can do something here. And I started to work on trying to do a Python course. I tried to run a very early version of the paid course, which was a bit of a flop and probably ill-conceived. It really? Was a flop in that I tried to jam too much content into a day for people that really were not prepared to receive it. So that to them, it sort of seemed overwhelming, I think. And they probably didn't learn as much out of it as I would have liked them to learn. So then I sort of stepped back and said, okay, well, stop really focusing so much on that. And that sort of became the segue of me trying to create my free course as a part of like building an audience of people that sort of cared about what I had to say. And also as validation of, hey, is this going to be something that's worth doing? And it really quickly became clear that, okay, there's a lot of people that are interested in this. Like, I mean, the free course just basically took off way, way faster than I anticipated. Like, I remember like very early on in the process that I had some things that I had to do manually in that process of people signing up for the free course. And I was just getting so many signups that is like, okay, this is not, I mean, like, this is not going to work for like the next 48 hours. So at, you know, 1 a.m., I'm like, okay, these steps here have to be automated because I can't do, you know, X hundred entries of these manually tomorrow.
Right. And you automate that through JavaScript, right? I'm just kidding, Python.
You know, I think it depends on your email automation service that I was doing to send out the course and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
I think that was actually mostly Python, that there were some steps that I was getting that just required me to manually be involved.
Right.
I just needed to write the back end Python to make the API calls to say, no, every one of these things, like they all sign up on their own and I don't get involved in it. But the main thing was it was a very big interest.
Yeah.
And it was pretty clear. The other things that I'd been seeing with, you know, SDN and interest in automation, the stuff that was going on that Jeremy was doing, the public con, it's like, okay, well, there's something meaningful is going to happen in automating networks, which I thought inherently made sense, right? These are inherently just computers. We shouldn't be doing all this manual stuff we're doing. Now, how to solve it might not be as easy, but we really shouldn't be doing all these manual things that we have historically been doing. So there was a very, very widespread interest in this, in network automation. And it became very clear, okay, this is going to be a real big trend in industry. And I think, you know, the last decade or so has really, you know, demonstrated that. Obviously, it's a work in progress. I think it's going to be a work in progress for a long time, but there clearly is a lot of things going on in network automation. And I think that's how it should be, really. You know, these are network devices are a type of computer. They should be automated in mass and much easier than we currently do.
Yeah. There's so much to unpack there. I mean, you create MVPs and you test out the water and you pivot and you kind of reinvent yourself several times through that whole process. So I want to get to that. But in the beginning, you kind of mentioned it, but I want to dig deeper in that is you mentioned you were a longtime network engineer. You went through your CCIE and it was kind of natural, like learn a lot of computing and Python, in fact, but that wasn't always the case. I mean, I was a network engineer and I went through my CCIE around the same time, I think 2008-ish is where I got my number, but it didn't occur to me that I should go learn Python. So, and in fact, I think your course gave me validation. Like I saw your course and I'm like, there's another dude out there who's validating that this approach works. And at the time, my company was using C#, and they were like a big C# shop. And But your content gave me confidence that this would work, especially your library. And then I went ahead and took like Python courses from you and from like the local university extension and so on. But how did that happen? Because I'm still confused on how did that happen. I mean, nowadays, you know, Golang and Python for sure. And Python is by far the leader and you contributed to that. So how did you discover Python? Why did you think it was the right fit?
Yeah, so when I was building my SaaS application, I actually went through this. This was before I had really been influenced by like, oh, network automation is going to be important.
Sure.
When I was just trying to decide whether I should, you know, what language I should use to build that, I really looked mainly at Ruby versus Python. And yeah, if you sort of step back to 2010-ish,
yeah,
the Ruby on Rails world had a big presence in the building SaaS applications
right.
space.
If you look at like Instacart, who started in 2010, they're all like Ruby.
Yeah, and Rails was very, very big then. So you could definitely make a strong case if you're just building a SaaS application and didn't know which language to use, that you could use Ruby and Rails to do that.
Right.
But I literally just sort of looked at the characteristics of the two languages and I sort of decided that Python was more
free. Did you like throw a dart on the wall and go, Python it is?
It just seemed like a more of a fit for me.
Mm.
Now, I think that was fortunate because if we fast forward a couple of years after that and we're looking at the market of what language was going to win in network automation, you obviously had Perl, which had sort of won from like 98 to maybe 2010-ish.
Sorry, I threw up a little bit in my mouth when I heard Perl.
Yeah, I mean, but it was sort of the dominant scripting language.
No question.
A long time. But it was clearly dead. And something else was going to replace it.
Right.
And really in the system administration world, that was really either Ruby or Python, you know, broader than just network engineering. And you sort of had the first generation of the config management tools like a Puppet and a Chef that were both built on Ruby. And then you had the second generation like SaltStack and Ansible that were built on Python. And I think there's a lot of characteristics about Python that sort of made it make sense versus Ruby to be the dominant language for network engineering. So I think it was fortunate that I chose Python originally, because I think there were certain factors of characteristics of Python that were going to make it very good to be the choice for what network engineering should use to replace Perl at that time. And, you know, obviously I sort of influenced that to a certain
large part, I would say.
But I think it was going to be probably what won out, you know, for the next decade, you know. So I think it was good that I was well positioned to be involved in that and to do things in that space. And I think Ansible is also a pretty significant factor there that, you know, Ansible was going to sort of be an important tool. And you could sort of make a statement that, you know, Ansible's probably the most important tool, like it or hate it. It's probably the most important tool. And you could definitely make, you know, strong arguments. Well, is Python more important or is Ansible more important currently to the network automation space? But one of the ways that you deal with the pains and the scars and the hatred of Ansible is to break out into Python. So there is this coupling of knowing Python is very helpful to make your Ansible actually work in the way you want it to work, or to make it simpler to do certain things anyways.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, Python today, I would say it has won. But at the time during that time frame, it's not very clear that Python is one. Like you said, Rails, and you know, if you go back to the SDN controller, it was written in Java to begin with. you know, a lot of companies who are using, still using Perl, and then there was like C#. So did you have a computer programming background so that it gives you kind of this insights on the characteristics that you're looking for versus like the job that you're trying to accomplish?
I mean, I had had a computer and electrical engineering degree. I mean, from, this is like too long ago, from a long time ago. And I'd done...
Yeah, we won't mention the years, but...
I'd done a fair amount of programming with that. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question of why, you know, if you're saying like 2011 through 15, why did Python win? I think Go was probably too early.
Yeah, because there was no machine learning back then, or yeah, Go was pretty early.
I think Perl was clearly dead. So I really think it was between Ruby and Python. And I just think Python is a little bit easier for system administration people at that time, probably a little bit more common for system administration people. I mean, there's a lot of similarities, like the gap between those things probably isn't, you know, as wide. I mean, certainly back then, I mean, there's been a lot more work, certainly in network automation since then. So it was probably fairly close, but I think, you know, Ruby was really pretty dominant, common is as building web apps because of Rails.
Yes. Yeah.
But you step into system administration, and especially with these second generation tools like Ansible and SaltStack, I mean, you could definitely see like why Ruby maybe should have had a better run, but it just really didn't go anywhere. And I don't really think Puppet, I mean, Puppet, neither Puppet nor Chef ever got very much play in network automation. Like people were sort of excited about them early on, but they sort of died and faded away really quickly. And then Ansible and, you know, SaltStock is certainly more important than those two as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned Ansible, and I think that played a big part of it. Whereas the Puppet and Chef of the world, they're more relying on agents, on, you know, installing on your remote targets and having this eventual consistency thing. But whereas Python and Ansible, or Ansible in particular, I think what drove that a lot was it Peter? I'm going to butcher his last name, but I want to say Spergata. From Arista, and he really joined. He, you know, he joined Ansible and really drove that path down where you don't rely on agent, you don't rely on Python interpreter installed on your remote, but rather just do what you can have. And also, I think a very important aspect of it is it allows the vendors to have some kind of specialization on extensibility, right? So I think a lot of these other tools, I don't know if you agree, I would love to hear your thoughts on this, but a lot of the other tools like trying to make commoditize the remote agent, right? Like the Dell is not that different than the HPs of the server of the world, but and then they're just trying to make the target uniform. Whereas Ansible, it allows the Aristas to differ from, you know, the Cisco of the world, but they still kind of have this uniform base while still have the Arista advantage, so to speak, still within the Ansible realm. That's my feeling on that. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the things that attracted people to Ansible is one, you know, since it was using SSH as its transport primarily, it seemed very familiar to network engineers. And even the question of, okay, well, what do you mean about agent when we're talking network devices? Like, it doesn't really do me much good to have, I mean, with caveats, to have an agent on another Linux machine that then has to connect to my network devices, right?
Right.
I mean, that's just distributing load, but also adding complexity. Ultimately, we need to talk to the networking devices, and maybe some of the networking devices you can run because they're just based on Linux and have capabilities for agents. Maybe you can just run some other software on them, but that's not everything, right? So you're still going to need other solutions. So Ansible being inherently this SSH based system with this way of sort of using the local machine just to make API calls, where you could then just connect to end devices, which at the time was just using Paramico,
right?
under the hood, it made it a world that was very familiar, at least with some of these transport mechanisms. And then having this lightweight YAML language to do things seemed fairly simple. Now, I'd probably argue that in practice, it didn't end up being as simple as we thought, and maybe programming in YAML was not such a great idea. But at the time,
it was great to get started.
Yeah, it's very easy to get started and
right.
then to bang your head against the wall for a while.
Right.
Let's pause for a quick word from NetBox Labs. NetBox Labs helps you build and manage complex networks. NetBox Labs can help you drive your network automation initiatives. As a network source of truth, NetBox Labs provides a foundation for device provisioning, automated testing, monitoring updates, and more. The company's NetBox Cloud product offers an enterprise-grade SaaS version of open-source NetBox, the world's most popular network source of truth. As the commercial steward of NetBox, NetBox Labs actively invests in the community to grow a thriving NetBox ecosystem. NetBox Labs helps customers accelerate network automation by delivering open, composable products and supporting the network automation community. Check out their educational network management webinars or join a NetBox meetup. Find out more at netboxlabs.com/events. That's netboxlabs.com/events.
Then let's move on from that. So you pick Python and you invested a considerable amount helping a bunch of people like me, bring me along on that path. You also mentioned, you know, maybe some of the lessons that you learned from starting your first company. And, you know, I smile a little bit during that process, not to make light of the situation, but I too have tried to start at a VAR that just fell on my face and lost a bunch of money. I've been to that boat where, you know, lost a bunch of money at the end of the day, and you don't know if this is going to work, and you're trying to pivot, go and try another direction. So, you know, what are some of the experiments that you ran to eventually find, you know, that was trigger and getting the signs that to go all in? I mean, besides there's a lot of sign up, which is a very clear indication, right?
Yeah. So if I zoom back towards like, I guess this is probably like 2012, 2013, when, you know, I was basically at the end of my ropes trying to get this SaaS business started. I started to be pretty heavily influenced by some people online with some of their approaches to business. So like Amy Hoy and Alex Hillman, they had this sort of online, and they still have it, and it was incredibly valuable to me. This course called 30 by 500, which is a course for, you know, how to build a business. And they had some very interesting and helpful ideas around, you know, how to find a market that might be good for you, how more important is actually building an audience. And I'm paraphrasing it with how I interpreted it.
Sure, of course. That's why we're here. That's what we're interested in hearing your perspective. Yes.
And how to go about building an audience. So I use sort of this free course and using an email to sign up as sort of saying like, well, if somebody's not willing to give me an email address for something I create, they're not going to buy something from me.
Right? No,
you know,
no.
If they're not willing to like say, oh, what Kirk has created is valuable enough for me to just give them their email, that's sort of a first precondition. And I had had these failings where I'd sort of thought like, well, I had built something and I thought it was reasonably good what I had built, but I had nobody that cared about the fact that I had built it. There was a very small set of people that I could reach out to that I could say, hey, I built this thing, you know, this network automation SaaS application.
Right.
You care about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want that road again. So I basically said, I need to build an audience of people that care about that I've done something.
Right.
And I need to figure out how to do that. So I had sort of used the, you know, creating the free course, building an email list as like, well, if I can't get 1,000 people or X number of people to care about this, then I really don't have anything. And I sort of ended up spending, you know, I spent a lot of time making that first version of that free course, probably like 4 months of like something like 3-4 months of straight work. No consulting, no other. It's just like, I'm going to build this free course. And I spent a lot of time just probably like 9 months where I'm not going to worry about anything but besides trying to build a set of people that care about what I have to say before I even try to sell any product or make any paid version of anything. But then I did see those returns from like, okay, running the free course, getting a lot of signups. I could clearly see there was a lot of people interested in this. And so that was sort of my, you know, market validation in a sense of like, okay, people care about this thing and care about what I have to say here. And now I have an audience that I can talk to about this thing.
Right. I mean, there's a book called The Right It. And they talk about, you know, market validation, as you said, and they talk about different stakes in the game. So, you know, like giving the email address is like, they assign points to it. It's like giving the email address was 5 points. Be willing to buy it is, you know, 20 points and so on and so forth. Even if they just spent like $1 or $4.99, the interesting part is not the amount, but it's the fact that they're willing to go through that hurdle and, you know, yanking out their credit card and trying to do that. So, you know, 100% to what you were saying on building an audience and, you know, getting people to care what you're talking about. Because there's also another book called The Mom Test, right? Like when you ask people, is this a good idea? You know, they want to be nice. If you, Kirk, if you come to me and say, hey, I'm building XYZ, just because you're Kirk and I know you, I want to be nice to you and say, that's a great idea. Fantastic. And the premise is that, you know, you don't want to ask your mom whether it's a good idea because she loves you and she'll just say yes to everything.
Yeah, I think that mom test person was influenced by the Amy Hoy and Alex Hillman course as
Got
well.
It.
But I've read that book and I liked it as well.
Yeah, he also wrote another book. I think, you know, I could be wrong, but I also think he wrote another book called Write Useful Books. And that's the one I, you know, kind of, you know, going back and forth a little bit on the, whenever I'm confused on, you know, the content to write or whether it's blog or books, then that's what I would go to. So yeah, it's interesting how they all kind of converge onto the origin and kind of spread out. It's like the coaching tree that they say in NFL, right? Like a lot of these are just origin from the same place.
Yeah. And I mean, there's one thing to always like say too, when you start talking about marketing and business is like, there's a fundamental thing of here of you're trying to provide value to other people.
Right.
So, you know, there was a key cornerstone here is like, okay, I have to make a course that is good and that I'm proud of having made and that people get value from. So it's all sort of packaged in there. Like, you know, it's presupposed that I'm not making something that's crap, that I'm just trying to pull the wool over people's eyes on.
Right. That gets crumbled down pretty quickly. I think it was Gary Vee who also said, like, he's, you know, you're only extracting like 1/10 of the value that you're providing. So like what you've done, right, your free course, probably, I don't know the sign-up rate, but it's probably a very big difference between people who take your free course versus the paid course. But you're providing so much more value that people like me willing to support you in your effort.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long time since I looked at the exact numbers, but I guess maybe like 1 out of 100 or 1 out of 200.
Oh, wow.
Something like that.
You don't extract value up front, right? You're providing value first, like you've done. And then, you know, at the end, you know, it has to be sustainable. So now there's a paid course if you want. And 1 out of 100 people will do that. So how many courses have you created? So I know you have the Python course, you know, both free and paid. And you keep on, you know, improving upon that, right? I constantly see you say, hey, here's the new version. And even if you don't announce like a major change, I'll see like the content being shifted. You know, so you try to keep up to date on that. I know you have the Ansible course. So tell us, what are some of the courses that you've done and that you're working on?
Yeah, so right now I have 4 courses and they've changed format slightly across time. But so I have my free course, which I run basically once a quarter. I think actually, I don't know exactly when this is going to be published, but there'll be a version that starts in early to mid-February of 2024, and then we'll run a next one about 3 months after that. So we sort of run that quarterly. Mm-hmm. And then I have 4 paid courses. So I have a Python paid course, and I sort of differentiate the two of those between the free course is really Python fundamentals, like I wrap it in trying to make it more palatable to network engineers. So the examples right. I give are a lot more network engineering friendly. But right. really, when push comes to shove, we're talking about Python. So we're talking about, you know, syntax, dictionaries, lists, loops, functions, ultimately classes. But we're talking about how to write Python code. And then my paid course is now much more of, you know, a certain amount of Python. Let's try to apply this to some network engineering tasks. So things like using NetMiko, using TextFSM, how do we interface to APIs programmatically? How do we use Napalm? So we start to try to do things programmatically using Python, but in the network engineering space. And then I have an Ansible course that's really Ansible for network engineers. So it's all about Ansible, and that obviously entails learning a certain amount of just about Ansible itself and right. how Ansible works, but then pretty quickly focusing on Ansible, but in a network engineering context, like how to use Ansible as network engineers. I also have a Nornier course. So that was created by Carl and I, Carl Montari, mm-hmm. Mondari and I. And I think you've had Carl on your podcast at one point.
In fact, he was he did a streaming with me. Okay. And we morphed that into like an episode as well. Yeah, Carl's a good guy.
So we have the Nornier course, and then I also have a NetMiko course. And then right now I'm working on this Git for network engineers course.
Yeah, why should network engineer care about Git? I mean, you know, obviously you already have those four courses. You could continue to, you know, evolve them and make improvements on, but what prompts you to think there's a need for network engineer to know about Git?
Yeah, so, and this is a little bit also relates to some of the AutoConf. So we recently had an AutoConf conference in Denver.
Yeah.
And some of my thoughts about where we are in network automation and how do we move things forward more. So I think using version control is sort of the pathway to adding continuous integration, continuous delivery, deployment. Right. So when you start adding, you know, Git to make commits to your changes, and this could be changes to your automation code, so Python code, Ansible playbooks. It could also be checking in infrastructure things. It could be checking in configs. You could be checking in information related to other systems, like what are your various monitoring systems? What are your various other information gathering systems? Maybe you have systems that are storing device information, like, you know, NetBox or an Autobot. So we're going through this process, but that process of making commits, of checking things in, is sort of the pathway to, okay, well, when we check things in, we should inherently have a sequence of actions that follow that. So a sequence of testing in some form should automatically fire off. Now, this obviously gets hard in network engineering, especially when we start talking about devices. And everybody knows if you have any sort of size of a network, you're not going to be able to replicate that in a lab.
Right. So your digital twin. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're a massive company, you're not going to spend, you know, tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars to build a lab, right?
Just to have a test bed.
Decide what's good enough testing, right?
Right. Right.
And how can we pull this off to have good enough testing? And, you know, what can we accomplish by doing one set of things versus what can we accomplish by doing a different set of things? And what's the relative costs of those? Now, I think there are a set of things you can accomplish with not very much, meaning like even if you just had a couple of lab devices, there's this aspect of like, is the config that I'm pushing valid?
Right.
Like, does the device understand it properly?
Right.
So there's a set of things that you could probably get without having much of a lab. And you could talk about, well, is my lab even a real lab anymore? Or is it entirely virtual? Is my lab, you know, built on containers? Am I using like Container Lab to accomplish this or some other tool to fire up and have this topology? So, and there's other things you could do, and there's other tools that people that built that might even not depend on, you know, live devices. But there's sort of this process of, okay, version control is the pathway to checking things automatically and to integrating this broader set of testing into how we view things to ultimately say we're going to deploy configurations or we're going to deploy this automation code that starts adding devices into our system, you know, our systems of record like an Autobot or a NetBox, or maybe they, you start by adding them there programmatically and then they generate configs from that. But, you know, this whole workflow, I think Git or some sort of version control system is sort of the pathway to that. And then for me personally, it was like, okay, this is a topic that I've used Git a lot, but it was sort of interesting for me personally to dive into it a little bit more technically to understand at a deeper level how certain things work, how, you know, I've mainly been looking at GitHub Actions for the CI/CD system. So a little bit better understanding of how GitHub Actions work, but that process has been personally interesting to learn something new and to create content around a new topic
for myself. Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, as a user, you could get up to speed on Git pretty quickly, but when you dive deeper into it, I mean, how do they come up with the hash value that to avoid conflicts, right? Like even things as simple as that, that you take for granted as a user, once you get deeper, it's going to be super interesting. But I think this is probably a good place to wrap up for the first part of our episode. You know, next part, we're going to continue to talk about, you know, the lessons that you learned from there, from creating this course or creating online courses in general, and so many other parts and interesting topic that we could talk about. But Kirk, where can people find you if they want to learn more about you, to follow your thoughts? Obviously, you have an email list, I imagine.
Yeah, so I think probably the easiest is if you just search for Python for Network Engineers, you should see me come up. and probably the easiest way...
Very, very top. Not a paid ad.
is the free course is there. You'll also be able to find me on Twitter just under Kirk Byers, under LinkedIn, under Kirk Byers. So those are pretty easy ways, one way or another, to reach out to me.
Great. And we'll have those in the show notes. Thanks for being on the show, but you know, stay tuned. We're going to have much more conversation with Kirk.
Yeah, thank you, Eric.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Network Automation Nerds. Do you have any feedback for the Network Automation or Kirk himself? Send me some follow-ups at packetpushers.net/FU. I want to hear from you. Check out our website at packetpushers.net to find more on network engineering focus, podcasts, blogs, YouTube videos, and Slack channels. Last but not least, remember that too much network automation will never be enough.